Welcome to the Becky Brooks Show, my friends. I'm so glad that you're here and that you've joined me today. I'm Dr. Robin Gould, and I'm going to spend the next about hour and a half talking with you about things that transform our heart and things that we ponder in the behind our eyes and before our eyes. And I love having that opportunity with you. So I welcome you. I'm sitting here in Florida. It's a rainy day. It's not really cold, but I still have that cozy feeling. So I have a hot cup of coffee here and materials I'm going to read from and share. And I'm so glad to be back. Actually, I just spent about 14 days in Israel. I was in the Erevah Desert in the Valley of Zin, a couple hours south of Jerusalem, in Erevot. There's an archaeological dig site and a place that people stay, this wonderful, amazing place that is run by Blossoming Rose, and they had some flooding, some very bad flooding, and they had damage. So I was there with several other people, and we were working on restoring some of that. So I just got back and I'm so excited to dig into our discussion. And that trip actually is what led me to want to discuss today's topic. I do have interviews scheduled for the next few weeks, but I had one more I thought we'd just do together ourselves. A word of warning, actually. If you have not traveled to Israel before, or even if you have, here's a little piece of information I did not even know, even though I'd been before, never had too much of a problem. I'm a fairly sensitive person to barometric pressure and altitudes. I'm just one of those people. I have a lot of sensitivities in many, many ways. And if you're in North America, where I am, you travel to Israel, you know, it's a 10-hour flight there and a 12-hour flight home. And where I was right by the Dead Sea the whole time that I was there. So previously going to Israel, I had stayed in Jerusalem a few days and then went to the Dead Sea a few days and then went back to Jerusalem and then flew home. So my body was able to adjust to these altitude changes. So some people might not even know, but the Dead Sea is actually the lowest point on the planet. It was below sea level. I think it's almost 1,400 or more feet below sea level, and it's very low. So when I got there, I actually had reverse altitude sickness. I was able to, you know, continue to do a lot of the things that I wanted to do to volunteer and help, but then I came back, I had full-blown altitude sickness, which was dealt with well, you know, with medication. But it was just a little bit of a lesson. So they said, hey, if you're going to Israel, spend a few days in Jerusalem or that area, then you descend to the Dead Sea. It really does make a difference. When you drive from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea, your ears pop like multiple times and then driving back. So it's good to adjust. So anyway, little piece of tidbit of knowledge for you to help your trip if to Israel. Hopefully you get there soon if you haven't already. And many of you that listen, I know, have been multiple times, and maybe you have stories like that. But anyway, that was my story. And this coffee is good. So I'm excited. So anyway, volunteering is always fun when you are with like-minded people with a common goal. So we actually had a really great time of fellowship together and very much enjoyed being able to be a part of that. And so it leads me into our topic today that I wanted to get into. And I've wanted to talk about this for a while, but I just needed the inspiration. And I have it, right? This was the time. Being out in the wilderness where he speaks to us will definitely inspire you to get into these seemingly shallow topics are not shallow topics. And today's topic, we're going to discuss from a Musar perspective, generosity. So if you're not familiar with the Becky Book Show or me or Musar or whatever, I'm going to just give you a little brief introduction here. So I'm Dr. Robin Gould, and I have I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. I specialize in attachment therapy, and I have a doctoral degree in religious education. So I travel and teach from an attachment perspective, the Torah, to Christians and Messianic people, and whatever set of challenges that they face in getting back to those original words and those first century words and concepts in the ancient Near Eastern culture. It takes a little work to get there and to figure that out and to sort out our feelings and the things that we've been taught in mainstream circles that we, in many ways, are abandoning and embracing new ways of doing things for us, new to us. And so it can be a little bit of a challenge. So that's why we have Becky Books, which was something that was spearheaded by Dr. Halissa Aylwine, who is the founder and the creator of the Creation Gospel. Are you familiar with that? Excellent curriculum. I would recommend that strongly enough. But she had this idea that people needed books that they could read in one sitting, maybe two, and there would be different tiers of how deep these books would go, but that there would be a friendly group of women who would take their talents, gifts, and the things they're good at and invest their time into making these resources, these affordable, vetted, reliable, non-snarky, very friendly and palatable, non-judgmental resources for people to be able to pass out to their families and friends, and to be able to rely on them and count on them and trust them, and even get a lot out of them themselves. So that's what the Becky Books are, B-E-K-Y, Building and Encouraging the Kingdom of Yeshua. And so there's a bunch of authors. I'm one of them. I've written four of the books. There's other authors. These are really great women of great character, and we have different topics that I think you would enjoy. So if you just go on Amazon and type in B-E-K-Y, the books will pop up. And you'll see we discuss primary topics like the dietary laws, the Sabbath, how to celebrate party style with the new ideas for the new moon. What is the Messianic service like? What is the Torah? Which traditions are good? What's a tear versus a tradition? There's a book on Hanukkah, book on the feasts of the calendar, on what the Jewish sources are. There's just so many things that you can read about and learn. And we take things, to their fuller scope. So even seasoned people might get something out of these books. And some are one sitting books. Some are maybe two. Some you can just keep rereading. I've really enjoyed the books. It's been fun even being part of the editing process of these books. I've learned, from these books. So anyway, just something for you to think about. And so that's what the Becky Book Show is. That's who I am. And I think we're just going to start on our topic here of generosity as I drink my coffee. And you, I hope you have your tea or your coffee or whatever you're drinking. But it is time for us to have our time together. So if you hear me sipping, I'm just making it more personal. How about that? So the book that I'm using, and the reason I do Musar from time to time, is because there's so many soul traits that Musar covers, and it falls in line with the whole spirit of what the Becky Book initiative and trajectory is. So you really can't go wrong with Musar. And so a lot of people, I get a lot of feedback on Musar topics, and they really like them and they request them. So Musar is Jewish ethics. And the book that I use is my favorite Musar book because it's very simple. It was written by the founder of the Musar Institute, Alan Moranis, and it's called Everyday Holiness, the Jewish Spiritual Path of Musar. And so today we're going to talk about generosity. There's many different Musar topics. They call them soul traits, right? Equanimity, order, simplicity, compassion, There's just a number of things. We covered a bunch of them, actually. But I wanted to talk about generosity. I wanted to discuss it. I learned about generosity on my trip to Israel. I learned that my fellow believing family were generous to me when I was ill and not feeling well. And I was generous with them in ways that I could be generous with them. And that give and take was really nice. That's not a balance everybody can do that well. I haven't been very good at it myself. I've been more of a giver. But that's not always the plan, right? Sometimes we have to receive. So I had a good lesson in that. But let's just get going. So I'm going to start in, I like to read a little bit from the book because I think Mr. Moranis just words things absolutely beautifully. And you know, Mussar just operates in the realm in which I operate. So it's the idea of attachment really fits with Mussar. Because Mussar helps you understand what your spiritual curriculum is, where you're headed with what you're doing, who you are. And attachment, part of attachment, people think it's all about how people view you and treat you. But a big part of it is also what you think of yourself and how you view yourself. Because that will affect how you present yourself. And how you, what your halakha, how you, what your walk is, right? And that's very important. So we're going to start with just this idea of generosity. And I'm going to start just by, before I quote from the book, I just want to cover one thing that I think has been very misunderstood. So I'm just sharing my personal opinion here about generosity. So there's a quote that I'm actually going to repudiate. I'm actually starting with a quote I don't agree with. And I say this in all kindness, and I just want to bring a point up. And it's not that I disagree completely. I just disagree with the way that this quote is interpreted. And it's kind of started a life of its own, which I feel like it competes with actual generosity. So let me read this quote. It's by Spurgeon. And he says, I'm gonna just read a small part of the quote. To give to others is but sowing seed for ourselves. So I'm not in disagreement that giving benefits us because, well, we'll read the Mussar perspective of that benefit. But it's really turned into this whole idea that you should give to a ministry in order to get something for yourself. So people have this idea, if I give 10% of my net income or my increase, I'm going to see my finances rewarded. So now I'm not saying that God's not blessing people who are givers and all that beauty in terms of his the way he works within the family, and certainly not suggesting I can dictate or govern or even know all his ways and all that. But we've gotten this idea that a misinterpretation of reaping and sowing. And it's actually a big pet peeve of mine. So let's just start with this idea. You reap what you sow. Okay. But what does that really mean? A lot of people think, if I, you know, send a whole bunch of Bibles to people in a third world, underdeveloped country that needs missions, I'm going to get a check for my mortgage. I mean, this is not an uncommon theology that I'm sharing with you. But here's the thing. If you reap what you sow, let's take it to a physical extent. Let's say that you sow seeds in your garden of zucchini and squash. You're going to reap, right? You're going to reap zucchini and squash that you can feed your family with. So that is a very simple way of understanding reaping and sowing. But the idea and the notion that you would reap, that you would sow and reap in a different way, is to really pervert that that passage. So if you send Bibles to an untouched area that needs the Word of God, what will you reap? Well, you'll reap the fact that these people that needed Bibles have them. That's what you'll reap, because that's what you sowed. And that is a beautiful thing to reap, because that should be the point of your heart. When you send money to people that are in need, impoverished people, what you're reaping is they have a warm dinner. Their children have clothing and education. They have a roof over their head. You're contributing toward their safety. So you're reaping within the family. That does not mean there's going to be a check in your mailbox that next Monday. And you haven't failed if that is what's happening. It's a very simple equation. We reap what we sow. If we sow into others, we watch them reap what we've given. And when we don't take credit for it, who gets the credit? That's right, the Father. Secret giving is wonderful. It blesses the other person so much, because all they can think about is how the Father loves them. Generosity is such a great topic. So I'm here in the book. Now, I hope that wasn't too controversial for you. And if it was, just think about it. Just think about reaping and sowing. And I'm giving you a very logical argument for what that really means and what our hearts should expect. This isn't an exchange. This is sowing. This is not a business exchange. This isn't doing business. This is giving. All right. So generosity. The generous heart gives freely. And here I'm reading from Everyday Holiness. But first let me quote Exodus, because this is an important thing to quote. So I'm quoting Exodus 25, 1 and 2 and 8. Okay, here we are. This is important. So perk your ears here. And God spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel that they should take a gift for me. From every person whose heart moves him, you should take my gift. And let them build me a sanctuary, and I will dwell in their midst." So here in Musar, they talk about Jewish tradition and the two different types of generosity that is encompassed in the idea of generosity. There's two different types. So the first is the giving that comes because your heart is so moved that without even a flicker of a thought, your hand rushes to dig into your pocket to give. In the Torah, they call this Truma, and this means gift. So that's what we're talking about when we're talking about sowing, right? When we are giving to needy people, that's a gift. We are not expecting a gift back. The gift is watching them feed their children. So this isn't like an obligatory giving. This isn't rational. This isn't out of guilt. This is this irresistible feeling that is deep, deep, deep down within you. It's almost like an impulse. It just sort of springs up and you just do it. You just do it because in your being, there would be no other choice. And that is a wonderful feeling, right? You don't even think about it. Your mind isn't even engaged. Your heart is fully there. Your mind just strategizes how to administer this giving. What do I have? What do I do? So you might have a friend and her pipes burst or they need help cleaning up water. And you hear, they call crying, "My pipes burst. I'm so afraid. I don't want mold to grow. It's, Saturday night and a couple days before I can get anybody out to help." And you don't, as she's talking to you, you are putting on your coat and looking for your car keys. You're not like, "Ugh, this is awful." Your heart is so moved in her, by her distress, that you cannot wait to get over there and be a part of the solution. And that just feels right. And this is not a sacrifice. This is just something you want to do. We could actually extend this to really parenthood, right? Your child is sick, and they need support. They need you to help them and care for them. And this isn't something that you are going to ponder. I really need my rest. I don't want to stay up with them. No, from the inner being of how you were created to be connected and nourishing and caring. From this place, this generosity, that doesn't even feel like generosity to you. It just feels like the order of things comes out. So that's that turma. And then you have another type of generosity, which is called tzedakah. You might have heard that, like in Shul or whatever, or Shabbat. Some children at the beginning of Shabbat, right before Shabbat, they'll put some money in tzedakah because they want to have the generous spirit of giving to people who don't have the rest, who toil and are needy and have less than you. So that's just a part. And that is obligated, right? So that's where you're teaching your child. Your child might not say, I want to give a portion of my allowance, but you teach them, right? Because generosity needs to be taught as well as a part of us. So there's, you know, these two sides to people. There's the spring within and the water we drink to feed that spring. So that's a part of us here with Musar. Okay, so let me quote a little bit from the book here. The overall goal of Musar practice is to help us fulfill our potential to really live as the holy souls we are. And it is impossible to imagine that we will shine forth in holiness if we act only from a sense of obligation. The passion and the flowering of the heart must be so much more. To move toward holiness, you must yearn for it. You must be propelled by a spiritual willingness. Nedivut halev, a generosity of the heart. We'll see, however, that these two forms of generosity are not so distinct as we might suppose. So there you go. You have the whole Musar kind of mysterious introduction of this idea that there's always connections to be made by everything that we are made of and commanded to be made of, right? Or to cultivate. And that's Musar. It's bringing the outside in, the inside out, and finding out what to keep and what to eliminate. So I love that. But what they talk about is giving from the heart. So that would be the sole trait of generosity, and really in a nutshell. It says, I'm in the book again, Everyday Holiness, and I quote, "The concept of generous and spontaneous giving from the heart appears in the Torah in the section where the Israelites undertake to build a sanctuary so that God might dwell among them." And that was the Exodus scripture that I read. Rabbi Meir Levush commented that the verse actually means that God would dwell not literally in the sanctuary building, but among the people. He concludes that each person is to build a tabernacle in his or her own heart for God to dwell in. The Torah wants us to see that the way we do this inner construction work is by perfecting spontaneous generosity. Unquote. So I find that really exciting and interesting because in the attachment work I do, we teach a lot about that sanctuary is not keeping something in, but it's keeping something out from corrupting that which is within. So from my perspective, it would be that there's a beautiful soil that's just perfect for all of the commandments to grow all the fruit that it needs to. And our idea and goal and halakha is a lot of it is to eliminate something that would corrupt that soil. And that can be different for different people. There are certain people that there are disputable matters about that, and people get very judgmental on it, which is another big pet peeve for me. Because what I might be able to do, maybe you can't. And, you know, this is talked about in letters in the first century writings that, you know, for the greater good, you always err on the side of caution, but we don't judge. And generosity and what that looks like is going to vary from person to person. And so the idea of each person creating a sanctuary, to me, makes me think of building walls and a door and using the wisdom of what stays out and what comes in for the glory of God. That's the piece of generosity that is exciting to me. That's what's exciting, because it is part of our attachment to the Father and our understanding of who He made us to be and how He views us. So I want to go back, and I'm looking in the book here, and I quote, "Because we live in a money-centric culture, we tend to think of generosity only as a question of reaching into our wallets. But as with all soul traits, generosity is a quality of the soul, and so it can find expression in many ways. You can be generous with money and also with your time, your energy, and your possessions. The one who gives tiruma," remember that was a spontaneous giving that came from within, "gives because his or her heart is so inflamed with magnanimity that it would be painful not to give. And the heart finds a way to respond spontaneously, whether with money, time, materials, or in another way. This sort of generosity is not defined by the kind of action you take or the amount you give, but by the energy of the response itself." So, and the author says, "I am pointing to a spontaneous, open, trusting, voluntary, inspired, internal overflow that erupts from the inner depths in response to the needs of or love for another." Unquote. So that's beautiful. That leads us into this whole topic of being generous with ourselves. It's not just, you know, donating money. It's not just giving money or building a wing on a hospital. A lot of people don't have a lot of that to spread around. But this is about being generous with ourselves. I want to read a quote for you. I really like this quote. And this is Adrienne Marie Brown. And this is what she says. "Do you already know that your existence, who and how you are, is in and of itself a contribution to the people and place around you? Not after or because you do some particular thing, but simply the miracle of your life. And that the people around you in the places have contributions as well? Do you understand that your quality of life and your survival are tied to how authentic and generous the connections are between you and the people and place you live with and in? Are you actively practicing generosity and vulnerability in order to make connections between you and others clear, open, available, durable? Generosity here means giving of what you have without strings or expectations attached. Vulnerability means showing your needs." I think that's very profound when you think of generosity. when we take it out of the realm of money, right, we're taking it into the realm of being generous with ourselves. Being a person walking in our truest selves, right? So that would be a person that is in covenant with the Father, loving covenant with the Father, and all about reaching out to other people so that their covenant experience can be easier as they are doing with you. Valuing others and valuing self. And the generosity piece can be shedding our pride and walking in true humility of letting our needs known. And so that's kind of what I opened the show with. I talked about my trip to Israel and having that reverse altitude sickness. I, of course, I thought it was just jet lag at first, and then I just really just didn't feel well. And I would kind of plug on and get things done. The heat was just 115 degrees. It was just extremely hot. So as I was sensitive to the heat in this sickness, the group's like, no, you do the work in this area where it's cool, and in this dining hall where I was, you know, able to do things that were helpful. And that generosity was so welcomed in my world. I'm usually, going to struggle with that, my pride or whatever. But in this environment, in the wilderness, there was really just that spirit among these people that I brought me to the table, and that brought something. And like I said, I did help, but I really felt the deeper message that the Father was telling me was that I was enough, that I was good, and I was someone that brought a good dynamic to this group that already had it. Like I said, each person really brought the dynamic, but together, we all were just together. And so it wasn't a matter of, competing who helped more. We all did our best and did everything that we could, and we did do quite a bit. I'm thinking some of the guys out there, my goodness, and women. I mean, it's hard to explain to you how hot that desert can get and the level of work that needed to happen. But I think that was a big piece for me to let go of and to be vulnerable and to have these beautiful ladies just, be helpful to me and check in on me and just demonstrate that I was valuable to them. And I just really, the guy that stays there, many months out of the year said that he sees this happen, that people are called to the desert for the Father to speak to them. And he didn't use the word spiritual curriculum, but boy, if he wasn't a Musar book himself, just walking, but he really understood that. So it's generosity can be very transformative, extremely transformative. And so I think that's really interesting. Let me read you this other quote. Let me look here. When I'm talking about transformative generosity, right? I love this. This is by someone named Steve Maraboli. And here's what he says, and I quote, "A kind gesture can reach a wound that only compassion can heal," unquote. I love that. Isn't that true? There is that piece of compassion. And as I mentioned before, it's also about the way that you view yourself and letting other people meet your needs and giving them that opportunity to do that. This is something that, let me read a little bit more here from the book. In Everyday Holiness, and I quote, "God is the model for this sort of giving." And that was talking about that reaching from your inner depths just because you want to. "God needs nothing and yet gives abundantly. In this way, God is intrinsically a giver. A person can also be a giver by intrinsic nature. Most of us would need to train ourselves to reach this level of giving, but it is possible. Then being generous becomes who and what you are," unquote. Now, there's some truth in that, and I will say that can go to a place that can be self-serving in pride, and I can say that I have definitely been a giver. I definitely have been taken advantage of. And sometimes I've really taken that giver identity on, which I don't think is what giving should be. It's an identity. It's an action, right? So, yes, we should be givers by nature and by heart. And I am a giver, but we must be careful that we're not trying to earn the points by the giving. Very important piece for anyone willing to humble themselves and to address that. We'll talk a little more about what excessive giving looks like in terms of like a perverted form of generosity. But let me go back here into the book, and there's something the book here refers to quite intelligently. It's called the stopped up heart. And I quote, "The human heart is naturally inclined to give. Caring comes easily to that organ, but it is not to act on that inclination only when it is open. That isn't always the heart's condition. When our hearts are closed or walled off, we are suffering from a spiritual ailment that the Musar teachers call timtum halab, meaning a blocked or barricaded heart, literally a stopped up heart. Instead of being open, flowing, and generous, we are sluggish, constipated, and unwilling at our core." Interesting. When you think about that, it's almost like a paralysis at the heart that prevents anything coming in, anything coming out. Why does that happen to us? If the heart is primed to be generous and is ready by its nature, how does its flow get to be so obstructed that we live without being generous? And what can we do about it? Sometimes we suffer from a stopped up heart because it is we ourselves who willingly blockade our hearts. There are things we do to build boundaries to separate ourselves from others. So interesting. Here's the example the book gives. In India, you hear lots of disparaging stories about the beggars. These are professionals who earn a fortune. And the book goes on to talk about how they swindled you out of money. So your generosity was basically a manipulation. You were being manipulated and you responded. And that can make people shut themselves off from wanting to give in that way. And actually, you have that in North America. If you ever watch those shows, those expose shows, they show a guy's, and this I've actually seen this, standing on this intersection where all this traffic went through every day, and he was taking money and just kind of wearing disheveled clothing and looking really needy. And then they followed him with a secret camera, and he walked about half a mile away, and he got into a nice car, and he drove about hour and a half and got out of the car and walked into a quite beautiful home. And come to find out, that was his job, and he made over $60,000 a year by pretending to be needy. And his wife had a job, and she brought in about that same money, and they had a beautiful home. And but he was far enough and unrecognizable in the area where he was, and he, you know, of course made himself look not recognizable, but really was upsetting to people. They interviewed people that would kind of daily give him like the change from their coffee or whatever, just to find out that he was manipulating them. So that person, those people are going to think twice before giving out because they have been manipulated and their generosity was abused, right? And that was something, you know, we've experienced that. People have taken advantage of us. I mean, I can tell you it just does not feel good when you trust people with property or you trust them with whatever, and they use and abuse you, and they don't care. That is something where we can build up a wall. And that's really painful. When there really, truly are needy people that suffer from that. So generosity, right? That person comes by that wall very honestly. because they had been manipulated. So yeah, that's just something that happens. So the stories, the book says, why do stories like these circulate, talking about the fake beggar? Because they're useful for building a wall around the hearts of people who are confounded by the requests being made of them. The heart is so sensitive that we fear it couldn't bear being open to the full onslaught of the monumental suffering of all of India's beggars. They're using that as their example. Oh my goodness. It says, drawn by the heart to respond, yet threatened by fear of overload, like I said, being taken advantage of. How comforting it is to have a rationale for shutting down the center of feeling, giving yourself a reason to turn away from that overwhelming pain. There may be walls around your own heart. The key is to be on the lookout for rationalizations that exempt you from being generous. With the goal of protecting your heart, you will tell yourself all the sound reasons why you must turn away. You then become less generous, and the victim is as much yourself and as the other. So that whole idea of putting that wall around, the Yetzer Hara, right? That voice that tells you to shut down and not give and be always suspicious, keeps you from walking in your truest self, right? That keeps you from walking in your truest self. It kind of goes back to that quote. It says, generosity means giving of what you have without strings or expectations attached. And losing that is painful. And people lose it legitimately by pain. But here's the thing. What keeps you hidden from generosity? And I would say that that would be our own methods to protect ourselves, rather than letting the Father protect us. And I am walking a very thin rope here, tight rope here, with no net, as I am talking about this with you, because you know as well as I do, and I know as well as you do, that this is probably one of the hardest things that we live with. And particularly in messianic circles, right? We have been hurt. People have been hurt. And that fine line of being generous with ourselves and not getting walked on, that can be a full-time thought job in and of itself. So hopefully we can simplify this a little bit by saying that it's not our job to protect ourselves, yet it is our job to be wise. And what does that look like? So let's read a little more. It says in the book, and yet it is you who has been a victim in this way. And if you accept that your life will be forever dictated by those experiences, then you do a different kind of damage to your heart. When our hearts are closed, we are the first among those who suffer from that closure. There may be good reasons why someone feels it's too risky to open up. But by tolerating that condition in ourselves, we accept an imposed blockage to our spiritual hearts. With a walled-off heart, our lives will be so much less than they could be, and the damage done is extended even further. And I think you are in touch with that, as am I. You know, we've had relationships that we've invested in, and that person didn't reciprocate. And we go through the rejection, we go through the pain, we wonder about ourselves, we wonder if we're good enough, we wonder if that person's good enough, we go through kind of this cycle of blaming yourself for not being enough, blaming them for not being accepting. But the biggest piece is, what is the truth about you? And that's the only thing you can stand on. And what's the truth about the other person that you know of? So you don't know what's going on in the heart and mind of that person that has closed themselves off to you. And it's not your place to judge it. It's not your place to even tell anyone about it. Here's what you do. You ask yourself, and you ask the Father, what's the truth about me? Well, you're fearfully and wonderfully made. and you're valuable. That's the truth about you. That's something that you can believe in. And that person is fearfully and wonderfully made and is valuable. And they are loved and they are worthy of love. That's all you know. And that's all you can operate in. So maybe you let that relationship go. And you just let the Father do in their life and in your life what needs to happen. But you're standing on the truth of who you are and who they are without judgment. That's a pretty powerful life intervention if you can actually do that on a daily basis. Keep your heart open while letting the Father protect you with the walls He puts up for you and not you doing it yourself. So here's a, I like this one here. Let me read this quote. It's Amy McTeer, and she says, "Share yourself often, easily, authentically, and generously from wherever you are in the moment." So that means we will vacillate in any given moment. We will back and forth. We will not always be in the place of extreme generosity because the Father's doing a work in our heart of teasing apart what true generosity looks like and what resentful giving is. And He might be working on you on something. Moment to moment, you're going to be in a different place. And then there's those open moments where you're just giving. Different people have different personalities about generosity too. Like one person might be just gregarious and open and extremely like vivacious in the way that they present their generosity. And it might be easy to just say, oh, that person is so generous with themselves. But this person over here who's quiet is not generous with themselves. And that's forming a judgment without knowing the heart of that person. Actually, here's a quote that kind of talks about this. I think this is interesting. And this is by Elaine N. Aaron. And she actually had written a book. It's called The Highly Sensitive Person: How to Thrive When the World Overwhelms You. And those are, people like that are out there. I'm one of them. I am an introvert that presents as an extrovert, if that makes any sense to you. But here's what this quote says. In short, you do not have to take the job that will create excessive stress and over-arousal. Someone else will take it and flourish in it. You do not have to work long hours. Indeed, it may be your duty to work shorter ones. It may not be best to advertise it, but keeping yourself healthy and at your right range of arousal is the first condition for helping others. Unquote. Now that is very interesting freedom to walk in. That you can address who you are, how you're made, how you tick, how you thrive. Because an over-aroused person that is overstimulated by the world and over just depleted does not have much to give. But maybe less time due to the intensity of their investment is how they give best. Right? So it's not one size fits all. Generosity is about investigating what your heart is, where your heart is, and from your heart, and the way that you are, and the trusting that the Father made you a certain way. So we have to stop with these sweeping generalizations of what generosity looks like in each person, and to accept people for the way that they are. What a beautiful community we would have if everybody accepted the way they were, albeit with a moral compass and self-correction and divine correction as needed. That's, of course, hopefully you know that that's a given. But in terms of just our arousal set points, our sensitivity set points, our personality types, can we just be accepted? I want to accept you in your personality, with your needs and your limits and your the way that you develop and the way that you respond and recover and repair and bounce back and enter in to conversations and into activities. people are different. Different people have different ways of being generous. So I think that's important to remember. That's just something that we need to ask ourselves. And here in the book, it says, the simple question to ask yourself is, do I give spontaneously from the heart? So spontaneous giving would be that organic, natural overflow of authenticity that you have based in the inner springs of who you are. And that will look different for different people. And one of the ways that we can even know that we can be spontaneous is that we live by rules. And that's where we get into, you know, the oral law and Judah having the scepter and conforming as a community to the way that we, our halakha is, right? Because there is no room for spontaneity when there is no measurement stick for the regular everyday. So that is not bad, right? That is not bad. So let me go into, the book talks about liberating generosity, which I love that. I absolutely love the idea of liberating generosity. So it says here, Rabbi Simcha Zisselziv, the founder of the Kelm School of Musar, wrote his book, Chachma Yumusar, which is Wisdom and Musar, just for the purpose of explaining how bearing the burden of the other is a profound spiritual practice. And he says, we have spoken about this bearing the burden of the other many times, he writes. This is the most inclusive of the attributes. He brings the example of the story of Moses, who began his spiritual journey toward becoming the greatest of prophets by responding to the suffering he saw around him, from which he had been insulated by living in Pharaoh's palace. He saw their suffering, the Torah tells us, and what he felt had a formative impact on his soul. Unquote. So when you think about Moses, you know, a lot of people get confused about the conversations that he had about with God. Like, if, you know, talking about, finding the innocent men and not having their residence destroyed, how many men would that be for God to spare this calamity upon these people who resisted covenant rebelliousness? But you can see Moses' heart toward the people, you know, if I find 10, you know, and he ends up just, can I find one? And it looks like to people, they get very confused. And this kind of tugs at their attachment with the Father because they don't understand him in this realm as changing his mind as it would seem. So I want to counter that with just mentioning this. Personally, the way I view that based on my understanding of the generic attachment law of the universe that the Father put in place is that the conversation between Moses and Adonai in this case was not for Moses to convince Adonai of anything, but it was a beautiful processing, a verbally processing, a developmental exercise Adonai had for Moses. As Moses is out of that insulated palace and seeing this suffering and working through it and digging deep into his compassion. I don't believe this was about the Father's mind or heart. The Father's mind and heart is set, for he so loved the world. This was about the human being, Moses, who was given a great task and needed guidance and development. So I have a mentor, a couple mentors, and one of them in particular will mentor me by asking questions she knows the answers to. And she will do it aggressively because that's what I need. She'll ask me a question. Did you run this through an analytic? You know, maybe I submitted something that was needed a lot of editing. And that's her question. And she'll ask it until I say no. And because that's what I needed. She knew I didn't, because it wouldn't have needed that much editing. If I had, you know, worked through some, using some of the editing tools that we all need to use, until we're more experienced. But that's part of mentoring. So here, Moses isn't, you know, getting the father to rethink his actions. The father is getting Moses to process his compassion, to talk about it with him, his guide, because Adonai is not going to steer him wrong. So that's a beautiful dialogue. And if you had any confusion about that, I personally really believe that that is what was going on there. That conforms to the image of Adonai as a merciful and compassionate and yet firm leader. The creator, right? The all-powerful sovereign one who doesn't need his opinions tweaked. But Moses does. Moses needs to process in a safe space. And what's more safe than when you're talking to Elohim, right? Nothing is safer than that. So that's kind of, you know, where I kind of, like I said, you cannot talk about generosity and the Father and not understand that attachment is the foundation of everything with the Father. So let's go to the other scope here of generosity, and then touch in. I mentioned we were going to touch on this, and here's what Alan Marina says. He says, and I quote, "I'll interject a reminder here that in the Musar view, not everyone needs to cultivate generosity. There are people whose sole work is to become less rather than more generous." So let me pause here. Like I said, I just had this experience in the desert, and I was called in that moment to receive care and understanding and mercy and compassion in my reverse altitude sickness, which I didn't know that's what it was at the time. And I'm glad I didn't know, because I wouldn't have done my soul work. But I was called to put the pride down and the earning mentality down and just walk in the authentic moment. So back to this book here. "There was a story in the news recently about a man who felt unsatisfied after giving away his $45 million real estate fortune to charity. And so he determined to give up one of his healthy kidneys to someone who was enslaved to a dialysis machine. No one should have two houses when people are homeless, and no one should have two kidneys while others struggle to live without one," Zell Kravinsky said. He did donate one of his kidneys and felt so good about it that he decided to go to the next step and give up his remaining kidney as well. He reasoned that it would be even more generous of him to free another person from dialysis, even though that meant taking his or her place on that machine. This is unbalanced generosity. To be solely, totally self-sacrificing, as he claimed, is not a spiritual virtue, because a total denial of self is a transmutation of a total concern for self in a backhanded and contorted way of serving self. It is egotism dressed in the guise of humility and generosity. So when we walk in the truth, so when I'm in the desert and I'm not feeling well and there are certain limits to what I'm doing, if I walk in lies and hide that, I'm not giving the people around me the opportunity to see the truth, and I am not walking in the truth. And neither are you, my friends. When you've gone beyond your limit, when your boundaries are all blurred, when you're unhealthy and wounded, and you're not open and generous with that information, you are not serving anyone. Now, of course, it's trusted others. That's the term I like to remind people. We need to, with wisdom, share our truth. And there will be times that people, you know, they don't accept it. Doesn't make it less true. But this sort of martyr fault self, right? I'll give to the point that I'm lacking, and then that's going to be where I glean my worth. What you're not doing is you're not gleaning your worth intrinsically from being a creation of Adonai. You're doing it with your own efforts. And that, my friends, is a very serious thing to do. That is what Adam and Chava did in the garden when they wanted to be like God. We're not God. We're human beings. And our value comes from Him and not from what we do. And He didn't design us to be like Him. He designed us to be human and Him to be our divine source of power. We have to remember that. And so, back to the book, it says, the law says that even the poor person who receives charity is obligated to give tzedakah, right? Tzedakah is the obligatory giving. The logic here is that the poor should not be denied the joy and reward that derive from performing the mitzvah of tzedakah. The Midrash teaches when a person gives even a small coin, he or she is privileged to sense God's presence. Even the wicked, who have no other virtue but the giving of tzedakah, are deemed worthy to greet the presence of God, and no one should be deprived of this reward. So when we walk in our false self of the strong one that can do everything and doesn't have needs and doesn't have feelings and all that, all those weak things that we embrace, these lies, and we walk in that darkness, we walk in that lie, we are depriving people of the ability to receive us in our truth and compensate where we can. Right? We deny people that reward because we ourselves see. It kind of underscores that we lack generosity because we think it would be such a burden for them to have it. When truly generous people, truly generous, are also able to receive and to enjoy that. They're able to answer the door and there's the neighbor that just felt like baking them a bundt cake. And they just take it in and they're absolutely thrilled and they feel worth it. They feel like, wow, this is nice. Thank you. I think that's really interesting. So I just love this whole idea of generosity. And you know, isn't it true with Musar? It's that we start talking about it and you think, okay, generosity is just sharing. But the more we talk about it, the more we realize how many layers of depth come with these Musar soul traits. And we could talk about this for days. Generosity has so many, is a kaleidoscope of different facets of the human being in relation to our divine creator and how we figure that out with him, how he figures it out for us and we accept what he, his process, right? That we're talking like Moses with him and he is helping us and walking us through the process so that we can talk this over, work this through and develop that balance. So in doing that, right, the idea is that the whole thing is to bring the family together, right? Well, that would be Elohim's greatest desire is that his family is together, right? That's what he wants. He's not like looking for people to exclude. He's providing a way for people to be apart because he loved the world, for God so loved the world. So here in the book, it says, I really like this. It says, applied to generosity, the principle is that giving arouses the heart to love. By obligating ourselves to give according to rules and formula, we expose our hearts to repetitive acts of giving that leave their trace on our inner lives. The very act of giving itself ultimately makes us more charitable, merciful, and loving. Love flows in the direction of giving, was Rabbi Dessler's teaching. This may also be what the Talmud means to convey when it teaches, if you want to bond yourself to loving your friend, give to him for his benefit. So there you go. That's the piece about people value things they invest in. So when you invest in your friends and you invest in relationship, you have found your way. that has aroused love in you. And that's where the authentic relationship develops. So, you know, it's good that we pay for things because then we value them. Giving away things sometimes is what we do, but a lot of times it's better for the person to pay a little bit of something for something so that they will value it. Right? And that's the whole idea of like fostering animals and children is, you know, your love for them increases by your investment in them. It's not because they're giving you something back. It's because what you're doing is flowing back to you. Because we're designed to be that way. I think that is a big, huge piece to remember. And I really think that's important that we always keep that in our mind. So there's so much more. I mean, I really hope you get this book and read the. It's a nice long chapter on generosity. It's actually there's a lot to it. Generosity, there's a lot to it. But I want to mention something that people usually bring up when we talk about generosity, and that's taxation. So people like are not happy about their paychecks being ravaged, over a third at least, taken and given toward things they don't agree with, things they don't believe in, but that the evilness of the state has deemed as legal. That's a very difficult thing for people. So I have a couple quotes I want to read, and you think about this. So first, it says, so this is actually J.R. Tolkien, which you would think, why am I quoting this? But this is actually such a great saying. And give with a free hand, but give only of your own. So generosity isn't promising the services of others. And it's not, you know, while we render to Caesar what is Caesar's, it's also not forced, laborious taxation to take from people for things that they don't agree with. And so that is a form of slavery. And, you know, here in Egypt, that's kind of how this goes. But living for others is about bearing that beautiful fruit that they can have that you've given because you're designed to give. And actually, I really like this. This was written by Israel Moore Avior, which is the leader's watchwords. And this is what he says. And I think this is really neat. It's poignant. Rivers don't drink their own waters. Trees don't eat their own fruits. The salt seasons the soup in order to have its purpose fulfilled. Live for others. So that's a really great concrete example of that flowing in and out process of the exchange of humanity. Luther Standing Bear, which is from a book called My Indian Boyhood. That's a really, really neat book. And he says, generosity is a mark of bravery. So all Sioux boys were taught to be generous. So some people might view generosity as being weak, but in that communal-based, communal-minded envelopment of culture, that was the strong thing to do, was all for the community. And not to the extent that it sacrificed you to the point that you weren't, you know, healthy or well. But living for others was a part of what their culture embraced. I wish we had more of that, actually. I really do. We're just so isolated. But, you know, meeting our own needs is really not what we are to be doing. The Father meets our needs, and we are to have the wisdom of receiving. And if we go into Matthew 6, 25 through 24, here's an example of him giving us this lesson. Verse 25, therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothes? Look at the birds of the air. They do not sow or reap or store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. There's that sowing and reaping, right? The Father is just in his own way investing. Are you not much more valuable than they? Can any one of you, by worrying, add a single hour to your life? And why do you worry about clothes? See how the flowers of the field grow. They do not labor or spin. Yet I tell you that not even Solomon, in all his splendor, was dressed like one of these. If that is how God clothes the grass of the field, which he is here today and tomorrow is thrown into the fire, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Right? In the word, there would be trust. So do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For the pagans run after all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be given to you as well. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. There's that real community instruction that when you're walking halakha in community, in a spirit of generosity, none is left needy. It's designed perfectly by a perfect creator. That is something that we can set our watches by and believe in, right? As we are building these sanctuaries, as we build these sanctuaries in our lives being sanctuaries for people to come in and be a part of your world, and you're generous with your heart with them, and you're open, and you're answering what questions you can answer, and admitting the ones that you can't, and setting your expert aside and listening to what they have to say, and being open to their needs, and being open with them about your needs, being vulnerable and being strong, right? But I repeat myself, those are things that go together. So I want authentic relationships that are true and that I don't worry about all the time. And that's been my spiritual curriculum this year. And I have wonderful women friends that are really helpful forces of divinity in my life, in just giving to me and taking from me just that right amount. And we help each other figure that curriculum out. And, they're very open with me. And I found generosity to be a huge part of my spiritual curriculum. There's a whole idea of walking in with the wisdom of generosity. And anything that is too much of anything, is a perverted form of itself. And that's how that works. You ever heard the expression, so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good? You know, people like that, they can be such a challenge because there's an overtness and a judgmental piece to their walk that they have put themselves in the judge seat. They are the controller. They are the know-it-alls. And they are the ones that know that you doing this hobby is wrong, but then doing their hobby is right. That whole idea. You can walk in extremes, right? And then there's no connection there with that person. You avoid that person. The whole idea of community is lost. And that's not to say that we abandon all discipline. Not at all. That's not what I'm saying at all. But we embrace true discipline. We embrace true acceptance and authenticity with our neighbor and with our brother and sister. And we walk in our truest self, and we are learning not to be afraid of that. We're not afraid to be human. We're not supposed to be like God. We're supposed to be the people he calls us to be who walk in his ways. But not who knows what he knows. That is not our role. He is to know. He is the sovereign. We are not. He's given us our little territories to manage. He absolutely has. Some bigger than others. Some have a bigger territory than others. But in different seasons. We grow in and out of these territories. We grow in and out of these relationships sometimes. Some of these relationships are enduring. Some of them are for a season. But generosity is a spirit. It's a soul trait. It's being in the spirit of generosity. And it's an exciting topic. And so I hope that you got something out of our discussion today here on the Becky Book Show as we talked about the spiritual soul trait of generosity from several different angles. If you want to reach me, my website is www.newcovenantpath.com. And I'm happy to talk to you. If you have any questions, I might be able to answer one or two of them. If I don't know how to answer them, I will point you to the direction of people who can. If something, you know, touched you or helped you or you felt was transformative, I'd love to hear from you. That's always very encouraging to me. But I really hope that you enjoyed this time that we've had together to discuss generosity. I pray that you can walk in generosity and you can receive generosity and that you can know what it is to be generous in an authentic way, in a wise way, in a way that brings glory to Elohim and brings functional, helpful dialogue and actions in the community. I really think that sometimes we miss the whole point by trying to do things in spiritual ways, and we actually miss the practical application of what that was about. I think that is a huge piece of wisdom. And to have fear of the Lord and to know that He cares very deeply about the person sitting next to you, and the way you treat them matters because you are accountable to Him. Because He has imputed value into them that knows no limits. Because He has created them. So the beginning of our wisdom is to have that fear of Him, that He has made us valuable, and He has made your neighbor valuable. And generosity is a two-way street and a beautiful soul trait to continue to struggle with, wrestle with, because through it you will get your name. So I have so enjoyed talking about that today. Thank you for spending this time with me. I look forward to next week when we will see each other or talk to each other again. I pray this might engage you in conversations with friends about generosity. Maybe it sparks wonderful clarity between friendships, helps people set better boundaries, open up, be spontaneous, and just to have that lighthearted, open friendship. In the midst of all of our serious, major, you know, conversations as well, that we can just strike that balance, that we can be spontaneous and we can be planned, but we can just walk in our truest selves. So I bid you shalom and look forward to our time together next week.